Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 145 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be continuing our rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be series 14, and in this podcast, I'll be talking about general surgery. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a kid that, you know, has like, let's say it's like an 18-month-old kid, has like mild right lower quadrant pain, and they tell you that his stools are guaiac positive. What's your diagnosis? I would hope you're thinking about like a Meckel's diverticulum, right? And remember, right, your friends at the MBM, you kind of expect you to know the buzzword pathophysiology behind Meckel's diverticulum, right? It kind of arises from a failure of obliteration of the vitelline duct, V-I-T-E-L-L-I-N-E duct, right? Occasionally, you see it referred to as, failed obliteration of the omphalomesenteric duct. It's one and the same thing. And generally, for the most part, people tend to find Meckel's diverticula in the right lower quadrant. Now, one high-yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBMEs is to know that you can make the diagnosis, right, by doing what kind of scan. It's called a Meckel scan, right? The thing is, they'll highly, very likely not put Meckel scan as an answer because that basically gives away the answer, right? Basically, what they will likely do on the exam is they will write something along the lines of protecnetate scan, okay? It's a nuclear medicine study with something called a technetium-99m protecnetate, okay? And the reason that those people get the bleeding, right, the guaiac-positive stools is essentially those people get, the Meckel's diverticula, right, they contain ectopic gastric mucosa, okay? And with those ectopic gastric mucosa, right, those secret acids, so that can cause like, you know, like erosion of like, of the mucosa, of the GI tract, and that can cause a bleeding. And the thing is, one weird, unusual thing that they could ask on step 2 CK is to ask. I guess I'll just tell you the factoid. The thing is, most Meckel's diverticula, believe it or not, do not contain gastric mucosa. I'll repeat that again. Most Meckel's diverticula do not contain gastric mucosa. However, if a patient presents in clinic, right, like the two-year-old boy, bloody, bloody, blah, firstborn, blah, 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 and it's like, they have like guaiac-positive stools and you discover Meckel's diverticulum, it's very likely to contain gastric mucosa. Okay, but if you take all the population of people that have Meckel's diverticulum, it usually does not contain a gastric mucosa. And then, what if they give you a question? And I mean, obviously, the way you treat it is with resection. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has a history of like Crohn's disease, and then they tell you that this person, over the last 2 days, has been vomiting, has been having a lot of like nausea, and they've not had any bowel movements. It could even be a person that has a history of ulcerative colitis, but this is likely going to be a Crohn's disease question on the exam. What are you thinking about? I mean, this person obviously has signs of a small bowel obstruction, right? And Crohn's disease, small bowel obstruction, what is likely causing the small bowel obstruction in the setting of Crohn's disease? Those will be strictures, right? Remember, strictures occur quite commonly in patients with Crohn's, and that can present with signs and symptoms of small bowel obstruction. Remember that strictures, if a person also has like a history of like long-term GERD, they can also have dysphagia from that because the GERD with all the acid and reparative fibrosis, they can get strictures with that. And that can cause signs and symptoms of like an esophageal obstruction. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of ulcerative colitis, and this patient has like severe abdominal pain, and the abdomen is like, you know, severely distended, they have rebound and guardian, or they may try to mess with your head on the test and tell you that the patient doesn't have rebound or guardian, they just have severe abdominal pain, history of ulcerative colitis, and they tell you something along the lines of the fact that, they maybe show you an x-ray, or they tell you that, they got some imaging and the obtained measurements of the diameter of the transverse colon, and I think the cutoff is like 6 centimeters or something. If you see that, what are you thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about toxic megacolon under those circumstances. Once you see toxic megacolon, what is your next best step in management? I would really, really hope that you're saying to go ahead and perform an exploratory laparotomy. Okay, remember, toxic megacolon is super life-threatening. Okay, and it's actually kind of high yield to know the other things that can cause toxic megacolon on MBME exams, right? So you can have things like, C. diff, right? So Clostridium difficile can cause toxic megacolon. And then remember that South American bug, right? Trypanosoma cruzii, okay? It can also cause a toxic megacolon. Those people need exploratory laparotomy, and those are kind of like big things you want to keep in mind. And then remember, right, if a person has a history of ulcerative colitis, let's assume the diagnosis is made right now, like in 2019, those people need screening colonoscopies 8 years after the initial diagnosis is made, right? So let's say starting in year 2027, those people need screening colonoscopies. But there's a small twist with that your friends at the MBME are beginning to think more about on exams, okay? If a person has a history of ulcerative colitis and PSC is diagnosed at the same time, so like primary sclerosing cholangitis, remember that's usually a P and K associated, you actually begin to screen those people for colon cancer starting at the time of ulcerative colitis diagnosis. Believe it or not, that's actually something very high yield to know. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient, you know, over the last 3 months, this patient has been having, you know, like they've been feeling fatigued, tired, low mood. They give you like vitals on the exam, and the patient has like a heart rate of 46, so they're bradycardic. And let's say maybe these people have like a carpal tunnel syndrome like presentation. What are you thinking about? I would really hope you're thinking about Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Remember Hashimoto's, right? These people, it's the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the US, right? One thing you don't want to mix that up with is a newborn. The most common cause of hypothyroidism in a newborn, right? So like congenital hypothyroidism is actually thyroid dysgenesis. That's a high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And remember, right, Hashimoto's, right? It's associated with like autoantibodies against like thyroperoxidase. Sometimes you may also see autoantibodies against thyroglobulin, but for the most part, it's anti-TPO antibodies, right? And if, for example, you were to perform a RAU scan, right, a RAU scan in a patient that has a history of Hashimoto's, what would you expect with radioactive iodine uptake? I would hope you're telling me that you will observe no uptake, right? Very minimal uptake on a RAU scan, okay? That's pathognomonic for Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? And obviously, you know, you go ahead and give those patients thyroid hormone replacement and they should be fine, right? So because they are hypothyroid, right, their T3, T4 will be low and their TSH will be elevated, right? But remember that there are many other things that can cause hypothyroidism, right? Like de Quervain's thyroiditis can also cause De Quervain's thyroiditis can certainly cause hypothyroidism, right? And you can actually have very similar values, like you have like low levels of T3, T4, elevated TSH. But the thing that will help you differentiate, and also like on a RAU scan, you will have like decreased uptake on a RAU scan. But the thing that will help you differentiate de Quervain's thyroiditis as the cause of hypothyroidism from Hashimoto's thyroiditis as the cause of hypothyroidism are the physical exam findings they will give you in the test, right? People that have de Quervain's thyroiditis will have like a painful tender thyroid gland, and they may or may not give you like, so they may or may not, they don't always give this, but they may or may not give you a history of exposure, like a history of like a recent like viral upper respiratory infection. Although, don't take this to mean that de Quervain's cannot cause hyperthyroidism. In fact, in the early phase of de Quervain's thyroiditis, those people tend to have hyperthyroidism. But as the thyroid gland kind of burns out from all the inflammation, they tend to get hypothyroidism. Okay. So in the early phase of the queer veins, right, they will have hyperthyroidism. So they are T3 because all that inflammation, right, can cause release of preformed thyroid hormone, right? So those people will have hyperthyroid symptoms. Their T3, T4 will be high. So their TSH will be low under those circumstances. But again, they will still have the exquisitely tender, painful thyroid gland, okay? And you also want to make sure you remember that, again, even if a person that has the queer veins can be hyperthyroid, they will have decreased radioactive iodine uptake on a RIU scan, okay? And if a person, let's assume they tell you to try to differentiate between a person that is going through the thyrotoxic phase of the queer veins thyroiditis versus a patient that has, that is, you know, factitiously injecting thyroid hormone. How do you differentiate between those two? Would you want to use the T3, T4 levels? No, right? Because the thyroid hormone levels will be elevated in those people, in both patient populations, and the TSH will be low in both, okay? Now, would you want to use like a RIU scan to differentiate those two? No, you can't, right? Because a RIU scan, right, will have decreased uptake in both situations. If you're factitiously injecting thyroid hormone, your TSH will be low. So because the thyroid gland is not being stimulated, you have decreased uptake on a RIU scan. And if a person has the queer veins thyroiditis, the thyroid gland is inflamed, so it will have no ability to uptake thyroid hormone, to uptake iodine. So there will also be decreased uptake on a RIU scan. And I mean, the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they will very likely not give you the physical exam finding of the also painful tender thyroid gland, because they know that will make it easy for everyone to get the answer correctly. And then if they don't give you that, right, what's the key thing that will help you differentiate between the thyrotoxic phase of the queer veins thyroiditis and factitiously injecting thyroid hormone? I would hope you're telling me levels of thyroglobulin, right? Remember, thyroglobulin is the C-peptide of the thyroid gland, right? So if a person has is in the thyrotoxic phase of the queer veins thyroiditis, the thyroglobulin levels will be elevated because that elevated thyroid hormone is coming from the thyroid gland, versus a person that is, you know, trying to maybe lose weight or whatever by injecting thyroid hormone. It won't work out so well for them because the thyroid hormone you can buy at the store or like as a nutritional supplement or whatever, although I'm fairly certain that is not sold as a nutritional supplement, can be associated with, it doesn't contain thyroglobulin, right? So the thyroglobulin levels will be normal in under those circumstances or decreased. And then remember, if a person has Graves' disease, right, obviously those people will, you know, they will be thyrotoxic, right? So they will have elevated T3, T4, their TSH will be low. But if you get a RIU scan, right, remember, these people have autoantibodies against the TSH receptor, right? They are called thyroid stimulating immunoglobulins, right? So because the TSH receptors are being stimulated, there's actually diffusely increased uptake on a radioactive iodine optic scan. And then remember that if a person has like an ovarian mass, like stroma ovarii, believe it or not, your friends at the MBME can give you some pretty nasty questions on that. Those people will have elevated thyroid hormone levels, right? So T3, T4 will be elevated, TSH will be low, right? TSH will be low. But there will also be, again, decreased uptake on a RIU scan, because that TSH being low means that the thyroid gland is not being stimulated. And then remember that if you're thinking about, like, you know, toxic adenoma versus toxic multinodular goiter, right, they present the same way, thyrotoxic symptoms, elevated T3, T4, low TSH, right? But the RIU scan results are different. There will be increased uptake on a RIU scan, but the results are different. For a toxic adenoma, you have only one hotspot on a RIU scan. For a toxic multinodular goiter, you have multiple hotspots interspersed with cold spots on a RIU scan. I'll repeat it again. For a toxic adenoma, you have one hotspot and then the rest of the thyroid gland is cold. For a toxic multinodular goiter, you have multiple hotspots interspersed with cold spots on a RIU scan. So I know, again, I probably took more time than I expected to talk about these RIU scan results, but I promise you that thyroid stuff is like floridly high yield in general for surgery questions on the USMLEs and also for like your surgery shelf. In fact, let me maybe go see some more things with thyroid, right? So what is the biggest risk factor for thyroid cancer? I would hope you're telling me like prior exposure to like head or neck radiation, right? Like radiation therapy to the head and neck. And what's the most popular kind of thyroid cancer? I would hope you're saying papillary thyroid cancer. Remember, papillary thyroid cancer is popular. Okay, that's a very high yield thing to know. And then, what's the kind of thyroid cancer that loves to spread hematogenously? That'll be follicular thyroid cancer. Okay, in general, on MBMEs, follicular thyroid cancer does not spread through lymph nodes. It spreads through the bloodstream. Okay, and remember that papillary thyroid cancer, right? What's a unique histologic feature? What are actually two unique histologic features of papillary thyroid cancer? So those are the sarcoma bodies, right? Sarcoma bodies. And then another thing are those often anii, nuclei, whatever thingies, okay? So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. And again, remember, papillary thyroid cancer is the most common type of thyroid cancer. What if they give you a question about, you know, like an 80-year-old guy, profound weight loss, enlarging thyroid, what kind of thyroid cancer are you thinking about there? This is the big bad one, right? That's anaplastic thyroid cancer. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has had like multiple kidney stones, and this patient has like chronic recurring abdominal pain, and they tell you that this person has, you know, like an enlarging thyroid gland, what kind of thyroid cancer are you thinking about there? I would hope you're telling me medullary thyroid cancer, right? And if you wanted to be more specific, what kind of MEN syndrome does this patient have? Is it MEN2B or MEN2A or MEN1? Again, I would hope you're telling me MEN2A. Remember, MEN2B does not include hypercalcemic problems, right? They don't have the parathyroid issues. The parathyroid issues, you find those in MEN1 and MEN2A. So this person specifically has MEN2A because medullary thyroid cancer is not a finding in MEN1, right? So this person has, you know, medullary thyroid cancer. Remember, the tumor marker is calcitonin, right? And if you do like staining of the thyroid gland, the people that have medullary thyroid cancer, they'll have like the apple green birefringence on Congo red, whatever thingy, because that calcitonin can sort of form all these polymers that can essentially become amyloid, okay? So if you ever see a person that has thyroid cancer and they have like a prolonged QT interval on EKG, really think about medullary thyroid cancer, right? Because that calcitonin, remember my mnemonic, calcitonin calcitones down blood calcium levels, okay? So those are high yield things you sort of kind of want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a rock hard thyroid gland on an MBME exam? I would really hope you're thinking about a Riedel's thyroiditis under those circumstances. So Riedel is spelled R-I-E-D-E-L, Riedel's thyroiditis, Riedel's thyroiditis. Remember that in Riedel's thyroiditis, right, you have like this fibrosis and badness that happens with the thyroid gland. You certainly want to make sure you remember that Riedel's thyroiditis has an association with IgG4 related diseases. Okay, these IgG4 related diseases, believe it or not, they are floridly high yield for the USMLE exams, right? So the IgG4 related diseases, they are things like autoimmune pancreatitis, where you have like a sausage shaped pancreas on imaging. They can also have like autoimmune gallbladder disease. They can have like retroperitoneal fibrosis. So that can cause like a bilateral hydronephrosis, right? Because you're essentially fibrosing the ureters, right? So it's kind of making it hard for the kidneys to drain. And then I know that I talked about sarcoma bodies. I think it's, you know, kind of imperative for exams to know the other things that are associated with sarcoma bodies, right? So you want to remember things like, there's this mnemonic you probably find in first aid. It spells out sarcoma. The P is for like papillary thyroid cancer, right? That has the sarcoma bodies. The S is like a kind of ovarian malignancy. That'll be a serous cyst adenocarcinoma, right? Of the ovaries, right? And then remember meningiomas, right? Meningiomas, remember they're the those things tend to be parasagittal, right? They tend to have like this dural tail, right? Those also have the sarcoma bodies. And then remember that mesotheliomas, right? I remember again, asbestos exposure, ferruginous bodies with asbestosis and all that crap. Mesothelioma certainly also has some morbidities. Okay, so I think that's all I should maybe say about like thyroid. I think I've kind of, you know, kind of hit that pretty hard already. So hopefully you get that. I don't know. I just always feel bad when people get endocrine questions wrong on exams, because usually pretty straight. Well, they are not usually pretty. They are pretty straightforward if you know what you're doing. But most people just try to like memorize endocrine blind, and then they end up hurting themselves on exams. Okay. Now, what if you get a question about a patient, you know, they've been having like nausea, vomiting, they tell you that the colon is distended, and let's say they show you like a coffee bean sign on imaging, and the head of the coffee bean is pointing towards the right upper quadrant. What's your diagnosis there? That will be what? That'll be a sigmoid volvulus, okay? But the thing is, your friends at the MD mirror, they've kind of realized that everyone that's in med school or even maybe the lay public, they've all memorized the word sigmoid volvulus, sigmoid volvulus, sigmoid volvulus, right? So these days, they're beginning to test the sickle volvulus pretty commonly. The thing is, it's actually very easy to differentiate sickle volvulus from sigmoid volvulus, right? The thing is, both of those disorders have the coffee bean sign, but in sigmoid volvulus, the head of the coffee bean points towards the right upper quadrant. In sickle volvulus, the head of the coffee bean actually points towards the left upper quadrant. Okay, believe it or not, those are things that are floridly high yield to know for MBME exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has, smoked 2 packs a day, 50 years. I mean, you probably kind of know what I'm going towards here. So like 2 packs a day, 50 years, 3 months, weight loss, doneness to percussion on auscultation of the chest, like with a lung exam, decreased breath sounds at the right lung base, blah, 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 blah. And then they tell you on imaging, you know, you see a large pleural effusion, you see a coin-shaped lesion, right? This person clearly has lung cancer, right? So if a person has lung cancer, right, if you see a person that has lung cancer and they have a pleural effusion, what is always your next best step in management? It's actually to get a thoracentesis, right? You get a thoracentesis and you send that for cytology, because here's the thing. If a person has lung cancer and you find malignant cells in the thoracentesis, your workup is done. The patient has stage 4 cancer. There's nothing you can do for that patient anymore. I mean, you can maybe, try to prevent the pleural fluid from building up by, putting like talc or doing like a pleurodesis or whatever. But yeah, once you see malignant cells and a pleural effusion, that's stage 4 lung cancer, end of story, right? Again, obviously bad prognosis under those circumstances. And remember, right, that if a person has lung cancer, remember that the most common, if they give you like a nondescript question, no paraneoplastic phenomena, nothing, especially like a female, and then they tell you that this person has lung cancer and you have to pick the type, I would really hope you're picking like an adenocarcinoma. Under those circumstances, I remember, right, your squamous cell carcinoma, right, that's the one that they can give you like histology results and they describe something like a keratin pearls. Under those circumstances, I remember those squamous cell lung carcinomas, right, they tend to produce a PTHRP, right, so like parathyroid hormone related peptide. So by producing PTHRP, those things can cause hypercalcemia. So those are key things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Remember that small cell lung cancer, right? It's the type where it has like 3 big time high yield paraneoplastic phenomena, right? So one can be like the Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, right? Where you make autoantibodies against the presynaptic voltage-gated calcium channel, right? So those people get like proximal muscle weakness, right? That improves with use. So it's actually kind of important to be able to distinguish a Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome from myasthenia gravis on MBME exams. The thing is, myasthenia gravis tends to cause more like bulbar symptoms, right? So they'll have, trouble swallowing, droopy eyes, almost like head and neck symptoms. But Lambert-Eaton tends to cause more proximal muscle symptoms, difficulty rising from a chair, difficulty combing hair, sort of deal, okay? And then remember that in small cell lung cancer, those people can also have SIDH, right? So those people, obviously, right, if you have SIDH, they'll have like hypo or smaller serum because they are reabsorbing a crap ton of water in the nephron, and they will have hyper or smaller urine, right? Because again, their urine is super concentrated. And then remember that this is small cell lung cancer can also produce ACTH, right? That's the one that does not suppress with the high dose of dexamethasone. And then remember that some of these cancers, right, can also cause superior vena cava syndrome, okay, right? So they'll describe a person, you know, that has like swelling of the face, prominent vessels, you can see them in the face, the neck vessels are kind of like distended. Think about SVC syndrome. If they ask for your next best step in management, go for radiation therapy first. They will try to mess with your head by giving you an answer that involves to give like IV steroids. Don't pick that. Pick radiation therapy first and then ask questions later, okay, to treat SVC syndrome. And then remember, right, that lung cancer can also cause a Pancoast tumor, right? So those people have like a Horner syndrome. So they'll have like the classic like droopy eyelids, so the ptosis. They'll have the papillary constriction. So they'll have meiosis. They'll have anhidrosis, right? And then remember that if they describe a person that, you know, is a long-term smoker, and then for whatever reason, over the like a month, the person gets like this sudden onset arthropathy, right? You don't go from having like no arthritis to like arthritis within like a month. And then the person has like this rapidly progressive finger clubbing. If you see that, you want to think about this paraneoplastic phenomenon known as hypertrophic pulmonary osteoarthropathy. That's pathognomonic for lung cancer. Your next step in management is to pick some kind of answer choice that relates to getting chest imaging. Okay. Let's see. Is there any other thing I want to say about lung cancer? No, that's all that really does come to mind. I mean, remember, right? Small cell, squamous cell, those are both central. Remember that small cell is actually of neuroendocrine origin. So neuroendocrine origin, that's kind of like something high yield to know. And small cell, once you make the diagnosis, it's already metastatic. And I know that I said that Pancoast tumors, right, are associated with, what is it called? Like Horner syndrome. What if a person has like a partial Horner syndrome? What's the MBME disorder that's associated with a partial Horner syndrome? Well, I would really hope you're telling me a cluster headache, right? People that have cluster headaches, they tend to get like ptosis and meiosis, but they actually do not get anhidrosis. Again, that's one of those like weird high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. And then to round up today, let's talk about some classic findings in certain diseases, especially maybe more, you know, like classic CSF findings. So xanthochromia is a classic CSF finding in what? That's a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? So like, again, worst headache of a patient's life, what should always be your first step in diagnosis? It'll be a non-con head CT, right? You get a non-con head CT. If that's negative, you get the lumbar puncture, you see xanthochromia. And the thing is, again, your friends at the MBME, right? They know that, again, every human being has memorized. In fact, maybe you've probably seen on Grey's Anatomy, oh, worst headache of a patient's life, blah, blah, blah. So they don't really do that crap anymore, right? The thing they do these days is they give you a question that kind of looks like meningitis, but it's a subarachnoid hemorrhage question, right? Because, and here's how you differentiate those things. You don't get meningitis in 2 hours, right? So if you see a person that has like fevers, nuchal rigidity, and it sort of like started like from like the patient was normal and he just started like suddenly, it's almost like they just boom, like dropped meningitis on that person like 30 minutes ago. Think about subarachnoid hemorrhage. Don't get tricked by that on MBMEs. And remember, right, if a person has a subarachnoid hemorrhage, if their blood pressure is super high, you know, try to control their blood pressure. And then you want to give them nimodipine, right, to prevent a superimposed ischemic stroke on top of the hemorrhagic stroke they just had. So xanthochromia, classic CSF finding in subarachnoid hemorrhage. Remember, right, if a person has, if a person has herpes, right, encephalitis, right, or herpes meningitis, right, they'll have like hyper intense signaling on MR of the brain, like in the temporal lobes. They can actually give you that MRI, and you're supposed to kind of like be able to pick that up. I remember those people tend to have like red blood cells in their CSF, right? And you cover that with IV acyclovir. Remember, if a person is not admitted for a herpes-related syndrome to the hospital, they have no business getting IV acyclovir. They get oral acyclovir. That's a high-yield concept to know. If you're not admitting a patient in general, giving IV medications on NBM exams, you know, it's probably not the smartest idea in the world. And then, what's the classic CSF finding in, I don't know, let's say like a person that's like an archaeologist, and this person, you know, over a 6 week period, loses all his memory, has myoclonus, blah, blah, blah. What are you thinking about there? Well, I hope you're thinking about CJD, right? So Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. I remember in CJD, right, those people tend to have, myoclonus. It's a bad disease. There's really no cure. Person is essentially screwed. And remember that those people have elevated levels of the protein 1433 in their CSF. You may say, Divine, that sounds low yield, 1433, who cares? I promise you, you should care, especially if you're having you certainly should care, especially if you're a person taking an NBME-based exam. And then what's the classic CSF finding in people that have, narcolepsy? So those people actually have low levels of orexin, right? Remember, orexin may also be called a hypocretin on NBME exams. And you'll make the diagnosis of narcolepsy, obviously, with a sleep study, right? They may not put sleep study. The $5 word for sleep study is like a polysomnography, right? Okay. And remember that narcolepsy, right, you can treat, you know, with like, you know, scheduled naps during the day. You can give them stimulants like modafinil or armodafinil. And you can actually treat the cataplexy, right? So like the person with like narcolepsy, they laugh and then boo, they keel over and fall, right? That's what's called cataplexy. You can treat cataplexy with a drug known as a sodium oxybate on NBM exams. So sodium oxybate. Oxybate is spelled O-X-Y-B-A-T-E. So I guess those are, let me go ahead and stop here. This has gone on for more than 30 minutes. As I do at the end of every podcast, right? I do offer one-on-one tutoring for a ton of exams, right? So step one, 2CK, step two CS, step three. And if you're a medicine resident, I actually tutor to the ABIM board exams and the internal medicine in training exam. And then if you're, you know, med student, I tutor for all the preclinical exams. And also the 30 ish off exams, I tutor for those. And then I also do this thing I call longitudinal tutoring. I've kind of talked about it ad nauseum. But basically, it's one of those tutoring setups that essentially, like, if you're like a newly minted med student, like you're studying first year, it's actually a pretty, like, the people I've done this with, they've been like super successful on the USMLE exams. I essentially tutor them for their class exams and for step one throughout like their first 2 years of med school. As I'm doing that, I'm like infusing step one knowledge along the way, and then they end up crushing their USMLE step one exams. Same thing, if you're newly minted third year, I can tutor you for all your shelf exams. And then I also tutor you for step two CK. Again, people that have done, there are just some very competitive advantages to having the longitudinal tutoring. Like essentially everyone I've done it with, most of those people have gotten like super high scores on their, like super high scores, like way above the national average on the USMLE exams. So if you're interested in any of that, reach out to me. And then if you're, you know, college student, you need tutoring for most of like the MCAT disciplines, so like Gen Chem, O-Chem, physics, biochemistry, histology, physiology, offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you need like, you know, consultant, right, or advising for the ERAS applications, right, so like writing personal statements, writing recommendation letters, because sometimes some people that write rec letters, they say, okay, you know what, write a rec letter and, you know, I'll edit it and all that, blah, blah, blah. I've worked with students on all those things. So like writing rec letters, assisting with personal statements, mock interviews, all that. I do offer all those things, editing your ERAS application. Same thing with the AMCAS applications, right? So if you're like a college student applying to med school. So I hope you've gotten something from this podcast. And I really cannot wait for the MBA season to begin. I don't know. I just literally don't watch TV anymore. There's really not much that's going on these days. And I'm really hoping that this is the championship year for the Lakers. So I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day and God bless you. Thank you.